Before we jump into the show, we want to each episode provide an update about Brisha Meadows. Brisha Meadows is a 15-year-old girl from Ohio who allegedly shot her abusive father to defend her family against him. She had cried out several times before. She had run away from home. She had told people that she was afraid of him. And so she was in fear of him. She felt as though he would kill their family. And so she allegedly shot him on July 28th. She was charged with aggravated murder. In December, the prosecutors decided not to charge her as an adult. I can't even believe that was a question. So she won't be spend life in prison. And she has recently, in January, been transferred to an adolescent, or she will be transferred to an adolescent treatment facility. But she hasn't gone to trial yet. And so we want to give an update on Brisha Meadows, this young Black girl in Ohio, every episode so that we keep her name and her cause out there. You can follow the hashtag #FreeBrisha on Twitter. The Brisha Meadows case is a collision of issues that we really, really need to face in our community. One of mass incarceration, particularly the mass incarceration of women and young Black girls. Black women and Black girls are often left out of the narrative when it comes to talks about mass incarceration and the incarceration of children. And Brisha Meadows' case brings this to the forefront and the treatment of Black girls by law enforcement. And it also brings to the forefront the issue of domestic violence within the Black community and the devastating effects that it can have on Black children. So we feel that it's important in each episode to continuously give you an update on Brisha Meadows until she is free and reunited with her family. So, all right, so let's get into the show. Came the time for me to know my purpose. Just who I am and what I came to be. So I had to swim into the open waters of the great big land outside my window. And then the whole wide world joined in the chorus. They said you'd be fine, but you need to know. It's a big world expanding from the inside out. Hello, everyone. I'm Crystal Tenille Irby, mother of four, three boys, and one girl.
And I'm Thea Monier, mother of three girls.
And I'm Nikisha Killings, also mother of three girls.
And welcome to another episode of Dim Black Mamas.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. That's better than last time.
You fell off, Crystal.
Yeah, I fell off because I went right into it after of, and then you guys took a beat. And I didn't know we were taking a beat. I thought right after of, we were going to go, you know, right into it. I think I like the fast better than the slow.
Yeah, I never understood the slow. I didn't even know how we got there.
I think we just are naturally a little sing-songy.
Yeah, I think so.
That just felt right to me. You know,
it felt like a Luther song.
Well,
there you go. And you know, people from the South talk slow. Like, you know, whenever. Whenever Q Baby calls me, that's for those of you who don't know, that's my husband, Q Baby, because he's in Omega.
I cannot with this nickname.
On the show, my nickname for him is Q Baby. Don't hate.
We will not refer to him as such. No. Only she will. No.
No. As such haterish.
Ain't nobody saying that.
I got enemies, but it's cool. But whenever he calls me, he always, and he has actors on, he goes, question. Do you think that we should go eat dinner tonight or a movie? And that's literally how long the question takes whenever he calls and asks me something.
But the thing is, when he talks fast, I have to look at you for, like, the translation.
See, that's because you don't understand.
Chris, so I'll be like, what did he say?
See, and the thing is, he never talks fast. So you... So that's how hard it is for you to understand Southern Dog. He never, ever talks fast.
I feel like never he'd be on a roll or something. He'd be like, Chris, tap, 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 tap. And I'll be like, what?
That's probably all one word. He's probably just saying one word.
And now it's happening with RJ. Because when I get on the phone with RJ, he'll be just talking to me. And I'll be like, ooh, baby. Wait, Chris, what is what the baby saying? I used to be able to understand him when he was, like, really little.
And that's when he had, like, the white Southern accent. But now that he's switched schools and he goes, this, like, the soul brother black Southern accent. So
it's different.
Yeah, it's a little bit harder now. Okay. So in case this is your first time listening, this is our third episode.
It is. We're on a roll now. It's official.
That shows that we are committed. And we are in this for real.
We in this thing. It's real.
So
it's real.
Yeah. It's for reals. It's for reals. And you know when black people put an S on something, it's serious. Okay? So it's for reals. It's multiples. Okay. So Them Black Mamas is a podcast for us and by us. It's a show about the life and times of black women raising black children.
Yeah, baby. Follow us on Facebook at Dem Black Mamas.
Or hit us up on Twitter at Dem Black Mamas.
And you can follow us on Instagram at Dem Black Mamas, or you can email us your thoughts about the show. Or if you have suggestions for topics, we would love to hear them. You can email us at Dem, D-E-M, D as in dog, D-E-M, Black Mamas with an S at gmail.com.
And our newest exciting venture is a Tumblr. So check us out at dimblackmamas.tumblr, T-M-B-L-R, at .com.
And
dimblackmamas.tumblr.com.
And our first Tumblr post is lit! What's the name of the Tumblr post? What is it called?
The Tumblr post is entitled Kellyanne Conway is the new Miss Anne and White Women's Worst Nightmare. Y'all know that's been rattling in my spirit since we started this podcast. So y'all know I got stuff to say.
And we have been thinking about starting a blog, but we were going to put it off. But in the wake of the Women's March, which happened on Saturday, January 21st, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
The day after the inauguration, women marched all over the world, but a lot of black women were opting out of the march, decided not to attend, faced some pushback from white women. And when we were expressing why we didn't want to attend, we were seen as being divisive, which showed us that people really don't know the history or the relationship of black women and white women in America. And part of that relationship is the Miss Anne icon. The essay that Thea wrote really, really explores that. And we were also inspired by Jamila Lemieux, who is the vice president for men's programming at Interactive One, and she was a former editor at Ebony as well. She wrote an article on colorlines.com about why she was opting out of the Women's March. But we wanted to explore in this essay the particular relationship dating back to slavery of black women and white women in this country and how that relationship is still playing out today. So Absolutely. It's a fantastic post.
And Kellyanne Conway provides the perfect opportunity to look at modern day Miss Anne. Mm-hmm. You know, I think for every sign there was out there about Trump, there should have been another sign about Kellyanne Conway, and there wasn't, because literally she got him across the threshold of the White House. Mm-hmm. It was her that came out after the video of him on the bus and legitimized him and signaled mm-hmm. to other white women that he was okay to continue to support. But that's what Miss Anne does. And if you understand the history of Miss Anne, you also understand how not just inappropriate, but just blatantly unfair it is to question black women's sisterhood or allegiance to anything. You shouldn't even fix your mouth to do that. And hopefully after they read this essay, they won't. But the idea also that you've assigned yourself as my sister based on our genitalia, when that's something that's much deeper for us than just genitals. Sister is such a big word with so much responsibility and love and bond
in the Black community.
Yes, especially because, you know, our sisters were not always about blood. Our sisters were about who was there in the trenches with us at the time. And like, that's what sisterhood at the end of the day means. Who has your back, like, unwavering? And that's not you. And you need to accept that. And why you would assign yourself that title without, hell, asking me. I mean,
And like Thea said, sisterhood in our community wasn't always about blood, because it couldn't be.
Right.
The average slave in America was sold 4 times.
Yes.
So blood ties were always being broken.
Yeah.
So sisterhood was created out of a sense of support and not a sense of bloodline. And let me just say, Tamika Mallory, Black woman, Black mother, one of the co-chairs of the march, this is not an attack on them.
No.
In fact, appreciate the fact that they were willing to come to the table, and we even celebrated them for that. But this is an understanding that both can be done. There can be Black women who choose to be at the table, and there can be Black women who don't choose to be at the table.
And both are valid.
Because of the history, both are valid because of the history of the relationship of Black women and white women in this country. And we have to face both sides of that, not just the sides that we are comfortable with, if we truly not only want to progress, but if we want to heal.
Yes. And I think that's the big part. Yeah. Like, I think that. Go ahead.
I think that a lot of people, of course we know it because we live this, but a lot of the people who are really confused by the fact that we weren't all 100% all in, don't necessarily understand how weighty the character of Miss Anne was throughout the entire it still is.
Every picture
now,
every
she was
lynching,
instrumental in the degradation and the humiliation and the physicality of the oppression. A lot of it was at her hand. And if you read the piece, Thea goes really pointedly into some of the laws that were put into effect to protect Miss Anne. There was always so much around to protect the role that she played in our hurt, in our dying, that it makes sense to me still in this day to be very wary about who it is I'm trusting and calling my sister in the fight, because they have not yet proven themselves to be that way. And to Chris's point,
all the way through now, we put up pictures of, like, you know, at the Trump rally, there's a Black woman, there's white women there, and they are doing nothing for her as a sister, right? You look at integration pictures. There's mainly white women who didn't want their kids going to school with Black kids. You look at lynching pictures. They're in the photos. You look at, I mean, you're there. You are there. You are complicit. You are equal partners. You were protected under the same laws. You cannot separate yourself from your man and hide behind him like he's the racist and you're not, when it's convenient for you. And the other thing is, this whole backlash against Black women, and I wouldn't say, I retweeted things about the march, I supported things. I mean, I thought, hey, if that's what you want to do, I think everyone should do it. But I think you should also respect my right to say, I don't want to do it. And that I'm tired. And the appropriate response would have been, okay, I got you. You know, sit this one out. But I think their reaction to us was also very indicative of their expectation that we be, and everyone's expectation, quite frankly, that we be the workhorse for rights and civil rights in this country. We're not, we are the vanguard, right? Because no civil rights have been won in this country without us ever on any level. But we're also now expected to be the workhorse of it. So whenever there's something, it's like, well, where are the Black women? And it's like, at some point, something happened within the last few years where we stopped looking back to see if you were looking for us or validating us. And now we're realizing there's things we want to do internally to move ourselves forward. Now we're building things and we're working on things internally, and our way of resisting or our way of healing and our way of moving forward does not look the same, because it's not centered on this idea of unity. It's actually centered on this idea of health for us.
I want to point out something important about Miss Anne, and the reason why it's important for all white women to acknowledge Miss Anne, because there'll be a lot of white women who hear the term Miss Anne and say, oh, well, that doesn't apply to me. You know, I'm in the fight. I'm there for Black women. But here's the thing. Black women and Black people hold each other accountable and call each other out or call each other in all the time. When people went to go meet with Donald Trump without an agenda, when people sang at his inauguration, when people worked for him, I can take you all the way back to George Bush, when people called out Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell. Black people have always been willing to call out our own people who we feel are working against our interests. I'm not saying that Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell were, but I'm saying Black people were willing to call them out. Black people were even willing to call out President Obama, the first Black president of the United States of America. So what I think Black women who don't identify, white women, excuse me, who don't identify as Miss Ann failed to do is call out the Miss Anns in their community and hold them accountable. Instead, they try to make room for them at the table. They place them as, oh, like I hear so many female journalists saying, oh, she's such a nice, Kellyanne Conway is such a nice person. She is a racist and she perpetuates a white supremacist agenda. And there have been no prominent white women willing to say that about her. I have looked for it. The only white woman who was willing to call her to task was Rachel Maddow. And even when she did it behind Trump's agenda. She didn't call her out as being complicit in that agenda. And so even if you don't identify as a Miss Ann, what Black women are saying to white women right now is that you need to go into your community and you need to call out the Miss Anns. Just like we call them out people in our community who we feel are working against the interests and the survival of Black people.
So and you do that by recognizing, first, let me check, make sure I don't have no Miss Ann in me. Because you probably do. I mean, I have, you know, I don't have a lot, but there's like two white women that I feel like are really down. But, you know, they, part of their strategy to make sure that they're in the right spaces is to check for the inner Miss Ann. But I do think, and I stand by the fact that the visuals of the march sent a message to the world that we were not just taking this, that we were not accepting of this, which I think is very important. These images are important for the world to see, you know, in case anybody thinking about bombing us, there's a couple folks here that, you know, may not be in agreement that you might not want to bomb. But I do think, you know, you haven't done anything since, like, okay, 53% of y'all voted for him. I haven't seen inner work. I've just seen you organize a march.
I'm waiting for what happens after the march. I really am. We want to see.
That's a lot of work to do.
And there's a, they have 10 steps within 100 days that they're sending out that you can do. And again, I think that that is great. But at some point, you have to acknowledge that you have to heal.
Right.
Because if we don't, we keep building things. We're building a movement. We're building things, but we're not healing. So what does a movement built on something that isn't healed do? It's like quicksand. You know what I mean? It's like building on quicksand.
But so also, they're going out here to march. They're going out here to march to prove that they're not a part of the 53%. See, and so this King makes this distinction very clear in that speech. In the speech that King does, the
I'm not either, because there were women at that march that voted for Trump.
Absolutely. Yeah,
there were women at that march.
But my point is that King, in his speech, The Other America, makes this point that he realized that the people who came out were coming out against the violence of Bull Connor, but not for the equity of Black people. And this is a distinction. A lot of people out there were coming out there to say, you know, that's not who we are, but not to say we are here to support the equity of X, Y, and Z. They were out there for their own agenda to make themselves look a certain type of way. And that's clear in the fact that what actual work have you done? The other thing he says is there's never been a single monistic, committed
movement to do that work
from white America to end racism. So when I say I'm sitting out and I'm not engaging in false allyship, this is what I mean. Like, to me, false allyship is we're out here about two different issues. And you know, we just pretending right now because it worked for you. But at the end of the day, I'll be at two rallies and you'll be at one. And I'm still waiting to see this single monistic committed effort come from within your group. And until then, I don't think we have an allyship, because I don't need you to come over here to my group and help me fight racism. I need you to start a movement within your group to start end racism.
And I've looked at the Women's March agenda, and I think that it's very progressive. I think it's a good agenda. It's an agenda that I am in support of. But I do think that the other thing that has to happen is that white women have to stop responding from a place of privilege.
Fragility.
And a place of discomfort, because it doesn't feel good.
And a place of, because the man is the racist. The man is, the white man is the racist, right. But we're not. That is right. The issue. That's right. That's the Kellyanne Miss Anne issue.
I feel like that's been a real key aspect of Miss Anne from the beginning, is this, I'm innocent, I'm fragile, I'm not the bad guy, but behind closed doors, when given the opportunity, she was meeting out punishment as much or more than her white counterpart. And we need to acknowledge that. We need to say that. And so hiding behind her fragility, we don't believe that anymore. We never have.
No.
I mean, Kellyanne Conway is the person who went on TV and said, maybe it's time for Donald Trump to install his own intelligence people.
She means that.
Like, she said that.
Yes, she did. She said she's the one who said alternative facts. Charles Blow has given us the appropriate language to refer to Kellyanne Conway. She will now be known as Trump's mistress of misdirection. Okay? Check the article, y'all. It's called A Lie by Any Other Name.
So go to our Tumblr, check out this amazing piece by Miss Thea Monnier, and let us know your thoughts on it.
Yay!
And again, we always want to thank everyone who's been listening to the show. And also shout out to Deaf Sound, who did the music for our last episode.
Thank you, Deaf Sound. Deaf Sound is an amazing artist. Check him out on SoundCloud, please.
Yeah, he's on SoundCloud. Deaf Sound. DEF Sound. And so I think that music kind of took us up to Tyra Weave season one finale. I think our
wait, isn't
show
that where we were last time?
Now
we were at season one finale. No, we were.
Last time I felt like we hadn't got to the finale yet.
I feel like you said season one finale.
I feel like we are.
So you guys
now
feel like we're season two, Tyra Weave? Okay, so
Riley's not here
now,
tapping on the floor.
Right, Riley's not here. So this episode we feel is America's Next Top Model, Tyra Weave, season two. That's where this show is. And a big part of that was Deaf Sound, so thank you so much. Well, Thea, we'll just go through
the lineup real quick. So y'all are learning the drill. We kind of do this thing in the beginning. And then we're going to go into our mac and cheese segment, which this time is on birth stories. Oh, Jesus. Gird your loins. It's going to be a lot of flashbacks. Trigger warning. Somebody get some ice chips up in here. So it's we're gonna do birth stories, and then we have some really amazing collection plate causes, and then of course we close with Black Mama Says.
Yes. All right. So our next segment is What's Good, and it's where we take the opportunity to talk about something that's happening that's really, really positive and light in our lives or the lives of those who we love. All right, Crystal, what's up? What's good is so good.
So a couple months ago, I got a message from a classmate of mine on Instagram that said she had to talk to me. It was really, really important. And so I gave her a call, and she said that she had a cousin who was searching for her father, and all roads ended at my father. And this is very emotional for me because my father passed away. We had a very tenuous relationship. My parents divorced when I was in the sixth grade, and he kind of disappeared from our lives in terms of physically being present for us, because I think he was so heartbroken by the divorce that he just really couldn't see past that to father his children. My sister and I met with this woman because who wants to walk through the world and not know who your father is? I just felt like, you know, if we could help her, then I wanted to help her. And I'm very clear about who my father was. So, you know.
Oh, there's some stories that are still haunting me. You know which story, Crystal. I just thought that was the lowest the lowest thing I had ever heard in my life.
My father was a lover, and so it's not outside the realm of possibility that he had a kid out there that, you know, he didn't know about. So we met with her, and we had a DNA test about a week ago, and the results came back that she was my sister. That is so crazy. And she just felt so relieved, and she felt like she had closure. And I felt like in talking to her and the questions that she had about my dad, it really gave me an opportunity to see my dad as a whole person. I think sometimes as kids, we see our parents as parents and not as people. And we don't understand that they come to the table with issues, that they sometimes come to the table broken, that they have demons, that they make mistakes, that they don't understand how to always get through things. And they bring that to their parenting. But it helped me to remember him whole. And to talk to her about him was really, oh my God, I'm about to tear up. Okay. To talk to her about him was really healing in a lot of ways because I used to doubt my father's love for me, but when I talked to her about him or when she asked questions about him, it triggers memories that I didn't even know that I had of him because I just remember him this one way and this man who made all these mistakes. But it helps me to remember that there were some good things. There were a lot of good things about him, and it helps me understand him more. I just wish, I think, for the first time that, you know, that he was here. Like, when you have a parent die, sometimes you forget that they're not here, especially because I didn't see my father a lot. So I just feel like, oh, I haven't seen him in a long time. And then you remember, I can't see him. But I don't ever remember having the feeling of wishing him alive. And I think that I wish that he was alive to meet her so that she could know him. And I think that that could have been a path of healing for us. And I know that it's been just a real, real unexpected path of healing with me when it came to my father. So I'm grateful to find out that I had another sister to help someone get closure and to help them find their full identity. And I'm also happy because I think that it's really helped me see my father fully and helped me heal a lot of things when it came to him.
That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's
yeah,
my,
that's a very that's good. But now my what's good is going to seem so petty.
That's great.
I don't have no deep daddy stories for y'all
just
today. Let me think. If I think about it, well, you know, Rogelio says I was actually suspect the other day. So, like, I don't even. Dang, my stuff. Well, I'm just going to go for petty. Crystal can corner the market today on the deep stuff. If you have not watched the John, is it Horter? Horton?
McWhorter?
It's W H O T E R. Let me just make sure I'm getting this right. Because there's a video of him on CNN with Don Lemon. Y'all know that I love shade. I love it. And I just think that Black people are like, oh my God. We are to shade what martial arts are to Asian people. Like, I mean, like, it's like an art form. It's like an art form. It's like it's sacred. It comes from the ancient times, you know. We probably could, if we really looked back on Egyptian temples, and it's like on the walls, like you notice they always side-eyeing. And in the hieroglyphics, they always side-eyeing. Like our shade is ancient. Our shade is ancient, is what I'm saying. I just feel like, and there's so many. Olympics. There's so many. So for real. Like, I think about, like, you know how there's different forms of martial arts. There's different forms of shade. And I just think it's just like, it's like street art. Like, people don't appreciate it, like, for its artistry.
Yes.
And so I'm always like, I love uncovering, like, a new brand of shade. And so,
right. So the hieroglyphic pattern. No, but
they always are to the side, girl. They always side eye him. So here's the thing. His name is John McWhorter, MC. Capital W. Oh, the two capitals, so you know.
Two caps.
He throws some good shade. Two MC, capital W, H-O-R-T-E-R. He teaches linguistics at Columbia, and he writes for Time, CNN, and The Atlantic, right? All this stuff. Let me just say, look up this video of him and Don Lemon discussing, we'll post it, discussing Trump's speech patterns. Here's the thing. Here's what makes this shade the thing that gives me life. I don't even know if he knows he's throwing shade, or I can't figure out which is more brilliant. If he doesn't know he's throwing shade and it's shady as fuck, or if he knows and this is just how he throws it. Either way, I am fascinated.
Either way, well done.
So he talks, he breaks down how Trump speaks. And, like, why it appeals to certain people. He says things like, he speaks a language that hasn't been committed to writing. Or he speaks like people after Thanksgiving dinner. His assessment was that he speaks like a 12-year-old. He doesn't complete sentences. And they showed this clip where literally Trump sounded like a bubbling idiot. And he's like, see, there you go. So he speaks in a language that has not been committed to, like, the written word, right? If it was on Deaf Poetry, maybe I would have been the only one in the aisles. I don't know. But I would have literally peed on myself in the aisles laughing. He kept it coming. Like, the jokes was just back to back. And the thing is, I don't even know if he knew they were jokes. I don't even know. But that bit of shade, do you, listen, you're going to get through these 4 years because he just gave you the blueprint. You just play that tape and you will feel it lifted my spirits. The other thing that's been doing it, the other good news real quick is I'm on book two of March of John Lewis's graphic novels. I've been finding so much inspiration, but also so much reality checking, right? About, like, what's coming up ahead. It's been great. So I recommend, if you haven't read it, read it. I think it's a good way to prepare your kids for what's coming. Is to read this graphic novel with them. But yeah, check it out, y'all. That shade is everything. Namaste. Yes.
Whoa, you brought the energy up in chia with that. I
told you it was petty.
All right. What's good? First of all, I have to say that I have reverted back to spelling my name with two caps because I'm bad like
that's
that.
Right. Okay, let's do that. Yeah.
And I threw a couple of extra letters.
Because it's the middle of the revolution.
She has phonetically on Twitter for y'all. Yes. Keep you up. You know, help you keep up. So, what's good in my life? I have a petty.
Yes.
And a not so petty.
Yes.
Following in the footsteps of Thea, I'll start with the petty. I should add a disclaimer up front that says I never ever wish any ill will on another.
Ooh, this is going to be some good petty. You got to put it out there that you don't want nobody to die. That's good petty.
However, the leap in my spirit when I saw that Fox did not renew the contract with Stacey Dash.
Oh,
what?
Yeah.
Listen,
how black did that feel? How black did that feel? Okay. They put you out to pasture. You got sold off the plantation. I can think of a million slave metaphors for this shit.
Speak on it.
And then, you know, like, we ain't got no jobs for you, boo. You're not doing anything with Taraji P. Henson in your life. You're done. Okay? Viola Davis wouldn't even spit on you at this point.
There's no coming
back. Viola Davis wouldn't even spit on you.
Spending all your time on Fox News. So I hope that guy you voted for, who was going to bring back jobs, can help you work out your situation.
Let me tell you, Omarosa ain't having that.
Oh, my God.
Omarosa, it could only be one. And Omarosa got that spot, boo.
Did you have another one, Nikisha, that was another, your petty?
Not, yes, it's not petty at all. I, in our very first episode, mentioned really quickly in passing that I am married to an active duty member of the United States Armed Forces, and he's a wonderful man. But what that means in regards to my what's good is that we're about to move again, y'all. We leaving this place.
When are you moving?
Move again. That's good.
When we moving?
When are you moving?
In a few months. So summer.
Yay! You're moving this way.
It's coming up. Possibly. We're waiting on official word any day now of the location. We have a strong sense of where it will be. And we'll keep y'all posted. But I'm just happy to be leaving this town.
Let me just say, if you and Thea end up in the same city, I'm going to have
she
issues.
She will.
Well. I'm going to have issues. I might be like Puff. I'm shutting down the podcast.
Because we filming together. That ain't right. Because we in here like, you want some tea, boo? You want some more pad thai? Well, I hope it's this way.
I hope so, too. We hope and expect so, too.
I don't.
But stay tuned. I'll let y'all know. But I'm just happy that the time is wrapping down here.
That'll just make you have to hurry up and do whatever you gotta do, Crystal. The revolution has already started. And guess what? They started it. So we late to the party. You know what this is like? I know this is a side note. But you know what this is like? You know what this whole thing with Trump and everything?
What?
It's like when you gotta go to court for custody, but you're not the petitioner. You're the respondent. Because somebody gonna file on your ass first. I think that's a little bit of how we feel. Like, wait a minute. We should have started the revolution. How they started before us? I think we was sleep at the wheel, y'all. I mean, we got to own this. They got about 8 years of planning
because
on
that. We had a black president. We was
and they're
at
the petitioners,
wheel.
You know. And whenever you're the petitioner, it's an uphill battle in the court, you know, because they like, why you didn't draft a petition? You like, I mean, because we had a black president. We didn't know we had to draft a petition. And then now, you know, they had drafted, they got the court documents in order and shit. Like, they got, like, investigators. And we sitting here like, we need a continuance, Your Honor.
Yes.
Can we get a continuance to get ready for this revolution? Then no, we didn't receive proper notification. Yes. Aren't they supposed to have to serve us? You got served.
Oh,
you got served
God.
On November 8th, boo-boo. You got served your papers on November 8th, and you needed to get an attorney as a representation.
This is what happens when you don't live by the sugar-free
this
creed.
Is, this
you know
is,
what I mean?
Listen,
we should have stayed ready.
We can apply this sugar-free. Creed to everything. If you stay
it
ready,
comes back
you ain't got to get ready. Because guess what? They live by it, and now they're the petitioners.
Yeah.
So we are going to transition into our mac and cheese segment. We promise you, don't eat nothing right now because we are going into birth stories and it gets real.
So when I was pregnant with RJ, my first child, I had envisioned his birth. I had gone to the classes, natural childbirth classes and the breathing, had read the books, like everything. I had envisioned his birth. I knew what it was gonna, you know, be like. I saw him coming through the birth canal, like all of that. Like I was there for it. At my last doctor's appointment, my mom was with me and I walked down the hall. And when I walked past, there were like four doctors standing. And when I walked past, all four doctors' eyes followed me down the hall. When I saw my doctor, he said, we're gonna have to give you an ultrasound because you're way too big.
Pause. Because I think when she says that, you're like, that ain't right. She was pregnant. I feel you as a woman. But y'all, she was big.
She was big.
Yeah. Like, I couldn't tell her at the time, but she sent me a picture. Yeah. And I said, well, great googly moogly. What?
People thought I was having twins.
Like, and she, you know what? She gets big early. Like, her babies get big by 5 months. We did a show with Yala Van Zandt. Yala thought she was due. And she was like 5 months in. So when we say by the end she was big, I remember her saying that the medical staff would want to go in and see. Because.
Yeah. Like, is it really just one?
Yeah.
Is it
like,
really
like
just
I don't know why. I don't know why she carried that big.
My doctor was the son of the man who delivered me.
Mm.
And mostly every baby in my family, except for one. You know, they knew our family. And, you know, but me, I was like, well, here goes the man telling a woman what her body can and cannot do. I'm not having it. And my mom was with you. And my mom was like, okay. This is the man. He's Asian. He's not the man. Well, he represents the man. he sat me down and he said, you know, I know you don't want to have a C-section. I know what your birth plan is, but I don't want you to be alarmed if the staff tells you that they're going to have to give you a C-section. I want you to labor as long as you want to labor, but I just don't want you to be alarmed. So I want you to go home. I want you to look at C-sections. And he gave me some things to read. It's like, I have seen my baby come through my birth canal. I am not about this C-section life. So I told my husband, and he is like, looking up C-sections. His friend has his wife's C-section on his phone, and he's watching that. My husband is an educator, and he was a principal. And I went to labor on the first day of school, and it was our daughter's first day of middle school. And I had this plan to take her, but I had gone to the hospital the night before, and I came home, and I told my mom, I was like, well, I'm a little cramping on the side. And my mom said, well, when does your period come on? And I said, oh, it comes on around the middle of the month. And she's like, oh, you're going to have the baby tomorrow. And I was like, what? She's like, yeah, the baby comes around the time your period comes on. Sure enough, I went into labor.
I have never heard that. Put that in the book, Makisha. Yeah. Put that in the book. You got to interview. You know, you need to just interview Etta May. That's all you need to do.
And so I went into labor 5 o'clock that morning, first day of school, first day of my our daughter's middle school, and my sister's birthday. So my mom, which is the worst possible scenario, had to drive me to the hospital. My mom is the type of mom who did not want to be in the birth room. She was in the birth room with one of my sisters, and she screamed so much, the doctor said, she's if she gotta screams go. Again, yeah. We're going to have her removed. Every time I had a contraction, she wanted to pull the car over and call EMS because she thought the baby was coming right then. You would have thought she hadn't given birth to 4 children. I don't know.
In a bit of while.
So we get to the hospital. She is wringing her hands. And she's like, when is he coming? Have you called him? Is he on his way? She's talking about my husband. Is he on his way? I'm like, yes, he's on it. Just, you know, relax. I got there at 5 in the morning. I am in labor until 7 o'clock that night, which is, I mean, I kind of expected a long labor. It was my first child, but I wasn't dilating. And every time I turned a certain way, his heartbeat would slow, and so I could only like sit one way. Well, eventually it was getting to a point where the heart rate kept changing. And so they wanted to do a C-section. And I was like, no, I'm not having a C-section. I'm going to labor. So they let me go on for about another hour. Rashad is totally nervous again. You know, he's like, I think. And I'm like, listen, men are not going to tell me how to bring this child into the world. Like, I'm just not going to have it. So finally, my mom comes in and she says, you're not any less of a woman if you don't push this baby out. The goal is to get this baby into the world. And so I break down and I started crying. And I was like, I don't want to have a C-section. They give you C-sections because they don't want to wait because it's inconvenient. And she's like, I wouldn't let them do anything to hurt you. Like, I know your plan. And she calms me down, and my sister is holding my hand the whole time. And so, you know, they're like, it's okay. I decided to have a C-section, and they come in, and they have to shave you.
Oh, dear.
Right? Well, I have been pregnant. I did not know that. They come in, and they shave you. Well, I have been pregnant. And
what
I
you're
had
saying
a really
is that
pregnancy.
Shit was like the Amazon
down there.
What you're saying is they came in with a razor and went back out and got some shears.
They come in with this razor, right?
I was about to make a 4C joke, but
we're gonna let it ride. Let's not make a 4C.
That's what it was. No, that girl. So they get ready to shave. And when the lady lifts my thing, my mom would go, oh my God!
How they expected you to get down there. They can't call you big and then expect you to get down there at the same time.
You know, right? I'm pregnant and I've had a tough pregnancy. You could have gone to get waxed. And I was like, I'm not trying to hear you right now. They're about to give me the C-section. So I started crying. And she goes, oh my God, I feel so bad for your husband. How is he able to get to it? Look at that. And she goes on. And the nurse is doing her best not to laugh. But she just wants to crack up. And she finally says, the Asians could have took care of that in like 2 seconds. You should have went to go see the Asians. I don't don't know what that means. I don't know.
Jesus, take the wheel. Was it the doctor agent? Oh, yes! My God.
Yes!
Oh, my God.
So the whole time this is happening, I am also letting out gas. Like, I started farting.
Oh,
and I
no.
couldn't control it because I had had an epidural. So I couldn't control the farts. Like, they just
kept
coming. And
this is a horror story.
Apologizing while my mom is talking about all of this hair on my vagina. The Asian doctor is trying not to laugh. And Rashad is just standing there like, it's really going to be okay. It's really
going to be okay. In the Southern accent.
It's really going to be okay, babe. It's really going to be okay. Like, that's it. So it's just too much going on. Like, I can't even deal with it. And they give you another epidural. And then they literally strap you to this metal thing like you're on the cross. Like, they lay your arms out. They strap your arms
do
down.
They?
And yes.
And put a curtain up.
And put a curtain up. And I start to smell burning flesh. They...
Yeah.
Open me up with a laser knife, and it burns your flesh to open you up. Like, you're bringing someone into the world, and you smell burning flesh. They had to take so much stuff out to get to RJ, and they take it out and they sit
Jesus,
it somewhere.
Take the, I'm
and
about
all
to,
you feel is
throw.
This.
Yeah.
All you feel is this tugging.
Yeah.
You. There's no communication
yes,
with
yes,
you between
right,
you and the doctor.
Right, right, right.
They get him out. They see him. And they like, oh my God, his umbilical cord is wrapped around his neck like 3 times. And which is why his breathing or heart rate kept fluctuating. Because when I would turn, it would get tighter. So finally, they unwrap it and I hear him breathe. Q-Baby goes to cut the umbilical cord, but they take him away. At that particular hospital, when you have a C-section, they don't let you hold the baby immediately. They literally take him out, came around the curtain, were like, they hold him in front of your face, here's your baby, and take him away. And they had to take him to the ICU to make sure that he was okay. I think I fell into a depression right then. You can feel them putting everything back in. You can feel them moving stuff around. And then they're sewing you up, and
no one's talking to you. Yeah.
It was really dehumanizing, bringing life into the world. And with my second son at a planned C-section, which I thought would go better, but they pump you with all this fluid. I ended up throwing up while I was on the table. They had to turn the table over so that I could throw up. And it was basically the same thing. The actual experience was traumatizing. Mm. And I feel like I'm just feeling my body again. So it was very difficult.
Part of the reason that we chose this topic is, you know, we on our social media, we've been sharing different information about the Affordable Care Act and that it provides expanded access to life-saving prenatal care for Black moms who die during birth at 3 times the rate of their white or Latina peers. I think that we don't really think about birth as a potential death. We don't think, oh, I could die having this baby. We just don't think of it that way. And it's so interesting because my, you know, women have been having babies for a very, 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 very long time. I think that's still a mystery that we haven't fully, like you talked about that detachment from the medical staff at times.
I would have never guessed that would happen with my doctors because during my visits and all that stuff, it was so personable. So I wasn't expecting
when
that.
When they get in their surgical load, though, everything changes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's what it is because my birth turned into a surgery.
Yeah.
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 So I have a lot of strong feelings about this. Y'all know this is very close to my field. Frankly, for thousands and thousands of years, midwives and fellow women in the tribe and in the community helped babies come into the world. While they certainly had a higher rate of infant mortality at that time, I don't think it was the best idea for birth to be medicalized the way it has become. Essentially, men took over the birthing process, the community doctor, decided that he was better fit. And so it became this really medicalized thing where, similar to infant feeding, we were convinced that we're not able to do this thing ourselves, that we need some sort of interference from an outside educated body to do it. And it's unfortunate because we've lost a lot of the natural aspects of birthing. Women in the birthing process, no matter how their babies come into the world, should at least get to enjoy the process and feel like they were empowered during it. And it's not happening. My birth experiences are very similar to Crystal's. I did not have rough pregnancies like she did. So I've had 3 pregnancies, 3 babies, and all 3 are cesarean. And like Crystal, I didn't go into this wanting or expecting to have a cesarean. I was quite naive with the first, and probably still, I'd say naive with the second. I didn't know going in that opting for the cesarean would really determine how many children we could have in the long run and how our family structure would be in the long run. I would have made a different decision. What's funny, I listened to your story and, you know, identified so much with it. The one thing I can't identify with is your mother saying you're not less of a woman if you don't push this baby out. My mother has said from before I was pregnant, this is a thing every woman wants to experience. She does not feel like she's completed womanhood unless she's pushed a baby out.
You get the opposite message.
And so that was heavy, right? So that's heavy going into that. And so I was in labor for over 20 hours. We got to the hospital on Sunday night. This baby didn't come out till Monday night. And all of that time I was being induced because I was a week late. Now, knowing what I know, I would have said, give me another week. But at that point, I was a week overdue. She was showing that she was on the large side, but I wasn't dilating or effaced or anything. No signs of readiness at all. So they began to induce me. They put the cervical softener in. They put me on Pitocin. They continue to crank up
the level of
Pitocin to the highest possible.
Yes, they will.
I didn't feel a contraction. Never felt one. So they were saying, it's showing on the monitor. You don't feel that? And I was like, I don't feel nothing. I don't know why I didn't feel them. I feel like it's a conspiracy now in looking back, but essentially, at some point, the doctor was like, you know, I know you really want to do this the natural way. I know you really want to push her out, but she's not going to come out that way. And I was like, I don't believe you. What would woman have done 100 years ago? And she looked at my face and said, the woman and the baby would have died. What you want to do? Doesn't leave a lot of options. So I was like, okay, I guess.
Had your water broken?
She had broken
my water. That's what sets the time. Once that water breaks, they can't be in there a certain amount of time.
Yeah. And I have to say, I've never heard anybody else say this, but the breaking of the waters was the most painful thing I've ever experienced. Like, I saw stars. I blacked out for a second. It was so painful. The way that she put that hook in there.
Oh, God.
It was horrible. And then my water broke and the baby was still pretty big. So it was just a trickle coming out. That was what she told me. I believed her. I trusted her. She had been the woman who'd been with me through the whole pregnancy. You know, been a really good. I purposely chose a civilian doctor, although we're military. I chose someone who, you know, was highly regarded in the community. And and went through a cesarean. The part after the baby came out was very similar to what Crystal said. Well, the whole burning of the flesh and the tugging and the nausea, all of that happened with me. And they let me see the baby and then whisked her away. She was gone for 2 hours. I didn't see the baby. But I sent my husband with her. You go with her. I'm going to be fine. You make sure. Because I had at that point become really certain that I wanted to breastfeed. I didn't want anything else given to the baby. And I felt I was really adamant about controlling some part of this process. So I wanted him to go with the baby. Yeah. Make sure I didn't give her anything. And that breast milk was the first thing that she got from me. So he went with her and they sewed me up. The second baby I had with the very same physician, but that time I went in a little more educated. While the doctor refused to do a VBAC, vaginal birth after cesarean, she's like, I won't do it. You have to find a whole other doctor if you want to do that. And I trusted her and respected her, so I stuck with her. This is where I look back now and say I wish I'd done different. But the second birth, I chose a different hospital. So again, I could control some part of the process. I chose a hospital that was going to be much more friendly to the mother. And in terms of allowing me to spend some time with my baby after the birth and encouraging breastfeeding, encouraging the bonding. So it was a scheduled cesarean. My water actually broke as soon as I got to the hospital for that one. So she was ready to come. The one thing that worked well for me throughout those surgeries was I had a great anesthesiologist each time who sat up by me and talked me through, okay, this is what's going to happen now. This is how you're going
to
feel.
So you have that personal person to tell you what's happening that Crystal didn't have.
Wow.
I did. I did. Mm-hmm. From the first time I had that, the second time I was like, I need to meet my anesthesiologist up front. I need to make sure that we gel because that person's going to really be the one keeping me calm. I actually tend to hyperventilate in the table. Once I got spinals, which is different from the epidural, so I am numb from the armpits down. When you cannot feel your chest expanding.
You feel dead.
When you can't feel yourself breathing, you feel dead. You really do. I go into a panic and I hyperventilate on the table.
What made you make that choice as opposed to an epidural?
On the first one, I got I had a bad reaction to the particular drug that was used. I had the itching for days. I felt like I was a crack just in there, just scratching and twitching and stuff. So the next time I mentioned that to the anesthesiologist when I met him up front, he was like, oh, let me try something different. I'm going to do this spinal using this combination of meds and you shouldn't have that reaction. And so we went in with the plan and that worked better. Third baby was at a military hospital. This time I had become much more educated and entrenched in the birthing community and wanted to try what's called a V2BAC. A vaginal birth. VB2AC. Vaginal birth after two cesareans. Mm-hmm. And I had the medical team focused with me on making that happen because I knew we wanted a large family and doctors get really antsy when they see a woman who's had three cesareans. They don't want to cut on her anymore. And so after having two, if you have a vaginal birth, you can then have vaginal births from then on. And you have to sign something saying, you know, essentially, I'm not going to sue y'all if me or the baby dies because this is such a dangerous thing. You know, it just, it's a whole thing. And they made me very, very nervous about it. Mm-hmm. But they still, to their ability, supported my desire to have a VBAC after two cesareans. And we tried and tried. And my water actually broke on its own on a Friday. And I did not have that baby until Tuesday. I started dripping fluid. She was huge. She was
Just pause. We just need a moment
to do the math.
Acknowledge that. Just need a moment. Okay, now repeat what you had said.
Water. I was dripping fluid on Friday. Went in and was like, I think my water broke. They were like,
But you know what that is, though, is trying to bring your child into the world in a way that heals you. I really applaud that. I really do.
I appreciate that. And let's say I gave it the good old Harvard try. I did my best. I labored. The contractions were so intense. I vomited with each one. It was a very, very painful, traumatic experience. And at some point they had a team of physicians like, you gotta just let us go in and get her. Like, there's no more time. You have to. By then I was so weak and so tired and I had no more fight left in me. That I went ahead and let them do that. It was devastating for me because again, we always said like five kids, you know what I mean? And now I have to strategically seek out a physician who's comfortable, an OB who's comfortable cutting on a uterus that's been cut into three times. It's a hard thing to find. And I've run into quite a few who are very uncomfortable with it, even though I've had every time they go in there, they're like, oh, it's like brand new, no scarring or anything. They don't know what they're going to get. Mm-hmm. And they don't know how well the pregnancy will even go with the amount of scar tissue that could be in there. And there's not a lot of way to go in and circumvent that. So we have to make some hard decisions about whether we want to continue growing our family and what that could potentially mean to my health in doing so, how much we want to do that. So my children are 2 years apart. You all know they're 4, 6, and 8. We were going strong every 2 years. So my point is, it's been 4 years since the last one because it was just so traumatic and we haven't really been able to say definitively if we're going to continue to grow the family or not. It's a really difficult decision to make. And it's a decision that has been made for us, unfortunately, to some degree, right? Those are my birth stories.
I feel like I should have went first.
Yeah.
These stories are like, first of all, I knew y'all had kids. I mean, clearly. But I knew, Crystal, you had C-sections. Nikisha, I never knew you had C-sections. So, I mean, I feel like my story is a little less eventful now, even though at the time I felt like I was traumatized beyond measure. Two of my kids I birthed. My oldest, Taya, was 36 hours. My youngest was 17 hours. I went in at 5 p.m. on a Friday, she came out at 5 a.m. on a Sunday. I did go in, you know, planning natural birth, and I was able to have both babies natural. You take it for granted. Like, there were things I think now, you know, I was young, but that I took for granted about being able to carry a baby, first of all, because a lot of women have trouble just carrying the baby, right? And then being able to birth the baby naturally, that I, at the time, didn't think of, girl, not in the middle of contractions. I sure didn't think of that as a privilege at the time. I'm just like, you know what? I'm just going to stay in this zone. But I remember the one side effect of my first daughter's birth is it took so long that my parents started talking again. And my parents are divorced. And like Crystal and Nikisha know, there's like some, you know, Real Housewives stuff in the background. They was in that waiting room so long, they had to start talking. That's how my parents started talking.
Look at God.
It was through Taya's long ass birth. Now, so with me, what happened was I was having the contractions, but I wasn't dilating. I was doing the walking around. I stayed home till it was a certain amount of, you know, minutes apart or whatever. Mm-hmm. I really liked the people who were helping me. And I think you're exactly right. There was a chance it could go to C-section. There was this moment where they were prepping me for C-section because they had been giving me Pitocin. And I should mention, I had no pain medication for the first 29 hours. I just did Lamaze. And honestly, it worked for me. When you really understand the birthing process, there's much of it is outside of your control, except how relaxed you are allow it, the whole process to happen. So that's what I did. And I went 29 hours, and I wouldn't ask any questions or anything. I would just be like, I'm in this zone. I'm just dealing one contraction at a time. At 29 hours, they had upped the Pitocin so much. I went into like one long contraction, and it was stopping Taya's from breathing. So they prepped me. Now, this is where it became traumatic. Honestly, that first part wasn't. It was like NASCAR. Like a team of people who I didn't know began coming in, inserting stuff. I remember the catheter. They just rammed it up there. And like just things like that were just so like, and nobody, like you said, no one talked to me. No one said what's happening. And here for me, who had been for 29 hours in so control and breathing and calm, for you to come in and just wreck that, like shatter it with no explanation, I hated that. And it demoralized me a bit in the process, where I was feeling rather empowered and proud of myself for how I was handling things. I did go to like this birthing center that was connected to a hospital. And so they were obstetricians, but they were also midwives. So they were trained in both. And both times I had women doctors. Mm-hmm. I was there so long that I actually, like Crystal said, you meet different people so that whenever you go in labor, you know who you're going to be in labor with. I had like two or three of them because I was in labor so long through so many of their rotations. But they were great in that respect. But it did become very surgical when they prepped me for the C-section. If the heart rate didn't come back, they were going to go in and just grab her. And bless God, it did come back. So when I got the epidural, the first one I got with Taya, it was like, Jesus, kiss me on my lower back. I can't even lie to y'all. I didn't realize how much pain I was in because I was breathing until that epidural just took it all away. And I was like, what? And I tell you, at that moment, I knew that the next child, there was probably going to be an epidural. I think I knew at that moment, like, you know, that's probably going to happen. And so for after 36 hours of labor, my pushing was like 30 minutes. It was wow. To me, that was the easiest part of the labor. They were trying to get the placenta out, so they were pulling it. When I say what you were saying about the tugging, like you can feel it, but you can't feel it. I know that feeling because that's what they were doing with that epidural, with the placenta. Mm-hmm. And that's also where my sister essentially lost consciousness. That was rough on her. Taya had meconium respiration. She was in the womb so long. So I was a week past the due date. She was 7 pounds, 9 ounces, 19 inches. So she wasn't too big, but she did have a bowel movement in the womb. So I didn't get to hold her right after because they had to go deal with the meconium respiration, make sure she hadn't inhaled anything. And I think it took me almost a full day to hold her. Having that day apart felt so weird. With Talani, who was 17 hours, I got the epidural after 10 hours. I remember, though, that everybody acted like I was some sort of champ. Like, I had birthed, like, 6 babies, and I was just, like, heavyweight champion baby birther. Because they were 18 months apart. So everybody had just been in that waiting room. Like, oh, she got this. It's still fresh. That is not the case. Don't do people like that, okay? Every child, you need to show up. The team needs to be ready, okay? Because I definitely feel like everybody was, like, more supportive with Taya. With Talani, they was like, she got this. Like, I just be birthing kids every few months. Like, it's not how it goes. So I didn't like that. I didn't like that. Everybody was too relaxed for me. But I did have the itching reaction to the epidural the second time. That was terrible. They did break my water both times, but I didn't feel pain. And I got to hold her immediately. And I just remember that they both had, like, really big eyes when it came out. Like, they both had really big eyes. And Talani laid on me. And then they cleaned her, and they brought her to the room. Now, remember, Taya, they took to the NICU. Like, she spent, actually, I may be not remembering this correctly, but because of the meconium respiration, we had to stay 3 days. And she wasn't in my room. Like, she could come visit to feed, but we couldn't be together for, like, 3 days. Uh-huh. Talani was able to come straight to the room. And I was like, wait a minute, y'all not going to take it so I can take a nap? I really felt like folks did me dirty with the second one. Like, I was like, I just gave birth. My mom was like, all right, y'all, I'm going to head home. I was like, who going to watch the baby? Who going to watch this baby? So it was, that was different. And I think people in general take it for granted that women's bodies go through this to have a baby, and that there are a lot of risk involved every time, but also that there's a lot more natural and ways you could work with that mother, child, and body to make sure it's a peaceful, healthy, happy. I understand emergencies happen, but they don't have to be traumatic. How you handle them don't have to, and you can think about long-term implications of this, not just this moment, which I think people need to do more. So, but I do think women need to talk about this more because birth is traumatic. When I hear people romanticize these things, birth is rough, period.
And I was a person who wanted to give birth at home. If I had to do it all over again, I would have chosen to do that. So being in that sterile environment was already taking something away from the experience that I wanted to have. And the compounding effects that C-sections can have on your body. Like, yes. After a C-section, women often have blood clots, they have infections, yes, and all of those things. So I think the key here is we need to teach women who are pregnant to trust their bodies and to trust what their bodies are telling them.
And I think to be educated, because from Nakisha's story, it sounds like the third time when you went in the most educated, you controlled the staff. And right. I think we go in there trusting them.
This is another part that's really upsetting to me, is because, you know, in general, C-sections are happening way more frequently now than they were even, you know, a decade or two ago. But of course, as in any other statistic, we Black women are having them at higher rates than any other group. We're having way more cesareans. So that maternal mortality rate is connected to the fact that we're having these surgical deliveries, but also that we're going in less healthy and we're getting less prenatal care. And there's a lot of other, and our physicians aren't taking us seriously or listening to us or showing the level of compassion that they do to other mothers. And so there's some systemic stuff going on, some institutional stuff going on that needs to be addressed when we talk about the experiences of Black mothers birthing. And it ain't all pretty. Yeah, reclaim your power. I think probably at some point in my life I'll dabble a little bit more into birthing and get into being a birth doula or a midwifery assistant. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be a midwife full on, but this is something that's of interest and of importance to me, because so many of us are having these traumatic experiences. This should not be the norm for all three of us to explain in some way how we felt disempowered through the process of bringing life.
And we hope by sharing these stories that you feel inspired to share yours with the women around you, so that this can grow into more of a movement where birthing becomes a process by which women are empowered and supported, because that's best for her and the child. That's best for all of us.
So now we're going to transition into our collection plate causes. And our collection plate causes are causes that we feel are worthy of support, whether that be financially or physically. These causes are also going to be posted in our show description and on our social media pages. We'll have links to where you can find out more information about how to support the things in our collection plate causes. So, Nakisha, you're up first.
All right, so I am going to talk about the water in Flint, Michigan. Lord have mercy.
We still talking about the headlines.
It has been over 1,000 days that the people of Flint, Michigan, have been drinking tainted water that is detrimental to their health. It started April 25th, 2014. There was a decision made where Flint switched its water supply from the Detroit Water and Sewage to the Flint River, which has been known for decades of being plagued with all sorts of toxic substances and fecal matter. And just, it was cleaned up in 2001, but still wasn't a good source for drinking water for people. And of course, Flint is 41% of the residents are in live below the poverty level, and their average income is less than half of the rest of Michigan. And of course, the majority of its residents are African American, of course. So this little city that was forgotten about, essentially, now getting water from a supply that's not pure, and it's just the water is corrosive to the pipes, and so lead from the pipes is what's poisoning the people. And this is especially harmful to children and pregnant women, to fetuses. High levels of lead can lead to all sorts of stuff, from impaired cognition to behavioral problems to hearing problems, delayed puberty. And fetuses are typically low birth and have problems with heart, kidney, nerves. It's just on and on and on. So there have been some agencies that are supporting Flint, who are helping them to get clean water and other resources, but here we are 1,000 days later, and the lawsuits are quietly closed, and legislators quietly turned the page and stopped focusing on Flint, and the people still have water that's not drinkable. If you want to, we encourage you to please, please support the people of Flint. Helpforflint.com is a website that lists out some resources and some ways that you can take action.
Thank you. Didn't know that it had been 1,000 days.
Yeah.
Okay. Tia, your collection plate cause?
Today I want to highlight one of the organizations directly impacted by the anti-abortion executive order that man signed this week. And just noting and being sensitive to the fact that people have different stances on abortion, but the defunding is for international organizations that do, we know abortion is one small aspect of reproductive rights and justice and treatment. And so that takes funding away from treatment for women who have been raped and who have been victims of human trafficking. It ensures safe births. It ensures wellness checkups and preventative care. It ensures menstrual care that helps these young girls to go to school in a lot of different nations. And so there's an article about the basically, after that order came out, the Dutch led and gathered 20 countries that would step in and fund what America had defunded for these organizations. And one of the organizations that they highlighted is the United Nations Federation Population Fund. And so, I went on the website and checked it out and looked at what they're associated with. And what I like about it is it's not just like one group of well-intentioned people coming in to help other people. It's comprised of people from these nations coming together to, like teach midwifery and support that kind of thing. And we will have the website up for www.unfpa.org up on the website. And that's my collection plate cause for this week.
So my collection plate cause is Sister Song. And Sister Song is a Southern-based National Women of Color Reproductive Justice Collective. And their mission is to strengthen and amplify the collective voices of Indigenous women and women of color to achieve reproductive justice by eradicating reproductive oppression and securing human rights. And this is important to me is because when you look at any statistic concerning women of color in this country, the statistics in the South when it comes to Black women are often worse than statistics in other parts of the country. So a collective that focuses on Southern Black women's reproductive health I think is so important and so critical. And some of their programs are reproductive justice training and leadership development, building Southern synergy, centering national Black women's issues and leadership, and arts and culture. So if you want to donate to Sister Song, go to sistersong.net. They're in the process of redoing their website, but you can go to sistersong.net and donate there. You can also follow them on Twitter at sistersong_WOC, which stands for Women of Color. So that's sistersong_WOC. You can follow them on Twitter. So those are our collection plate causes. Again, they're also listed in the description of the show. And we also have them up on all of our social media platforms. So do what you can to support those causes or find a collection plate cause of your own.
Yes. Now we'll move into our final segment of the show, which is one of our favorites. It's called Black Mamas Say. And it's where we take, I put a little bit of our spin on common sayings from Black mamas or mamas of the movement. Today, our Black mama say is, what you not finna do is. Mm-hmm. And I bet we've all heard that and said that mm-hmm. this week. Mm-hmm.
So, what you not finna do is shut down the entire science community because they have all gone rogue. And I'm for that life. I am following every rogue Twitter account that these scientists have set up. Alt-EPA, Alt-US Forest Service, Alt-US National Park Service. Who would have known that the National Park Service would be the rise in the movement? I'm just like, so, like, this is like something I couldn't have even written, right? Bad Hombre Lands NPS. I mean, they got some gangster to them. And here's my favorite. Rogue NASA. Yes! They are currently organizing.
We universal, baby. We universal. The revolution is universal.
Let me tell you, I never could have, I love sci-fi. I could not have imagined that scientists would go rogue from these federal agencies. And like, you're not going to shut down science. I mean, these are people who don't come out for shit. They spend their time in the lab. They don't come out for shit. Let me tell you, I think about going to this march. I have to be surrounded by these people who are like, fuck that, you can't shut down science. I want to see the signs. What will they say? What will the chants be? I want to report live for this podcast from the scientist protest march on Washington. I'm excited. And it's going to be like, they're going to probably have like electric signs. Not no regular ass paper signs. It's going to be like electric signs. So what you ain't finna do is come for the science community unless they have sent for you. Do not come for them. And they have made that clear. So that is my Black mama say. Listen, the new Malcolm is coming out of this shit right here. I'm just letting y'all know I called it first. You know what I'm waiting for? I'm waiting for Alt Army, Alt Marine.
Yes!
That's what I'm waiting for. That's where the T is. I'm waiting for that one. That is where the T is. Ooh, when them secrets start spilling, I'm going to be like, y'all ain't going to get me on the podcast. I'm going to be too busy reading them government secrets.
So my what you're not finna do is keep on using Black Jesus and MLK as scapegoats for your bullshit. Mm-mm. If you want to meet with Donald Trump, fine. If you want to sing with Donald Trump, whatever. Waste your time if you want to. But don't use MLK and the Lord told you to meet with Donald
or
Trump.
Obama.
Don't play Steve Harvey.
Your scapegoat, and then think that Black people ain't gonna come for you.
First of all, Jesus would never send Steve Harvey on my behalf.
No. Say that.
Jesus would say never. So whatever God is talking to you, there's medication for that, Steve. But he ain't spoke to me.
Then admit why you're doing that. If you're doing it for the money, whatever. If you're doing it for your ego, whatever. But the meeting ain't real if you going in there, number one, with no agenda. Then what you meeting for? That person ain't serious about your freedom or your survival. So what you not finna do is make Martin turn over in his grave again, because I'm sure he done turned over a thousand times every year around his birthday.
He just do a continuous roll. He don't even pause. It's just a continuous roll. It's just one roll.
Got the good brother just rolling.
So
rolling.
Stop using one sentence, one verse in the Bible without reading the whole speech, without reading the whole chapter. So what you're not finna do is think you're gonna go out here and use them as a scapegoat for your
psychotic break.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then try to play the victim when black folk come for you.
Yes.
You ain't finna do that.
Yes.
You ain't finna do that.
For me, what you not finna do is tell me I didn't see some shit that I know my eyes saw.
Yes. Yes.
You hear what I'm saying?
Yes.
But you know what?
You ain't gonna tell me that it's your white floors.
But you know what? You know what I love about that is your long pause after
that.
Because that is like a black bump thing. Like when you tell somebody, you say, what you not finna do, and then when you tell them what they're not finna do, it's a long pause. Like, I appreciate that, Nakisha.
Yes,
I appreciate
that. And tell me that I didn't see them empty bleachers.
Right. Right. So this is the thing that concerns me the most about this administration is they are trying to control the narrative on every freaking thing. They will let you see actual video of some shit occurring and then tell you, oh, you didn't see that.
Yes.
That's not what happened.
Yes.
That didn't happen. So what that is called gaslighting.
Yes.
Gaslighting is a term used to describe when something has occurred and the gaslighter is trying to convince you that you did not see or experience that thing. It is a tool of oppression and a tool of abuse. Abusers use that. They will cause you to question your own sanity after a while. Like, oh, maybe he didn't bust me in my eye. Maybe that didn't happen. Maybe I didn't. And they are relentless about it.
Yes.
They cover all their bases. They never let you forget this fabricated story about what actually occurred. That is a tool of oppression. Listen, y'all don't be fooled. Sip that.
This is good.
So that's what I have to say. That's all I got to say.
That was a great one. You ain't gonna tell me I didn't see them empty bleachers.
Yeah, that was good. But before we end the show, just real quick, can we please give a shout out to BET, who has really brought themselves back into my good graces. Can we give a shout out for the New Edition biopic? Can we shout that out? And let me tell you why I want to shout that out on this particular podcast. Because the Black Mama Magic, I'm about to tear up again. The Black Mama Magic up in this movie. What is it? Lisa Nicole Carson. Okay, what are the names?
Lala Anthony.
Yes.
Yvette Nicole Brown.
Okay.
Is Miss Bivens. Monica Calhoun is Miss Tresvant. And Lisa Nicole Carson is Miss Bell. And then Sandy McCree.
Those women are, everybody in the movie is good. The casting is excellent. I mean, the kids in the first episode.
Yeah, those babies did it. They did that thing.
They did it. But those mamas. The mamas bring it home. The mamas bring it home. So shout out to them. All that black talent up in them scenes, and they ain't getting no work. Y'all better wake up.
Yes.
Y'all better wake up. Y'all better look at them BET ratings and wake up. But they are killing it. They are giving you real
black
mama up in there. And so I just want to give a shout out to BET.
They said they knew they had to come right or else they was going to get dragged by Black Twitter. Like, they knew.
And let me tell you what they also said. They also said, check and mate, Lifetime. Check and mate. This is how you make a biopic.
Yeah.
You hire Robbie Reed to do your casting.
Did Robbie Reed do the casting?
Robbie Reed did the casting. Another Black mama. Then you work with the artist who the biopic is actually about to get to train the actors that are playing you. And then you get the rights to the music. This is how you do this. So, Lifetime, what you not finna do is another whack-ass biopic because everybody gonna be coming to BET.
Yeah.
Because they have set the bar. So that closes out our third episode.
I'm worn out. Birthday stories took a lot out of me.
Do your dance. Okay, so thank you guys for listening to our third episode. Again, you can hit us up on social media.
You can follow us on Facebook at Dem Black Mamas.
Or hit us up on Twitter at Dem Black Mamas.
And Instagram, Dem Black Mamas. Hit us up with your thoughts about the show, our topic. Show us some love. And don't forget our...
On Tumblr, too, at Dem Black Mamas. Because you got to read... They got to read the piece.
Yeah, you got to read the piece. Because what Dem Black Mamas is not finna do...
Not finna
is do. Let Kellyanne Conway off the hook.
No.
Dem
no,
Black Mamas no, is not finna let
no,
her
not
off the
mistress
hook.
Of misdirection. No. No, no.
And you can also write to us for advice because one of our co-hosts is a licensed
Yeah, I really want
therapist.
Y'all to do that. Let's do that. Let's make that happen.
Oh, you heard her. Write it. I'm telling you, Thea will get you right. She will give you some good advice.
I promise.
My advice is sure to go wrong. But Thea's advice...
You will be divorced and on the street following Crystal's advice.
If you take my advice. But Thea's advice will get you right. Ooh, Thea's advice will get you right. You see what I did there? Thea's advice will get you right. She's a licensed family and marriage therapist. Or if you have topic suggestions or want to know more about us, please shoot us an email at demblackmamas, D-E-M, blackmamas with an S, at gmail.com. And we're out. What is our namaste?
Namaste. Be good,
okay, so
y'all.
We do it three times, right? Namaste.
Are we doing it again?
Namaste.
Okay, you know what? Namaste. Good night and good luck.